Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Wednesday, January 29th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so. We'll go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me here as we push through the middle of Super Bowl week. This game finally getting a little bit closer here. We'll start things off with professional handicapper Brian Leonard from WagerTalk.com. We'll talk some Super Bowl. We'll talk some prop betting strategies. And we'll talk some Major League Baseball on that segment with season win total lines out there throughout most of the market already here in late January. Second half of today's show, Wes Reynolds will join me at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. You know him from VSiN and that Point Spread weekly newsletter. We'll chat with him about Super Bowl props as well. Then take a look at the Waste Management Phoenix Open down at TPC Scottsdale this weekend. A great golf tournament. Should be a whole lot of fun. And we'll get some good insights there from Wes. Over at bangthebook.com, we are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. We've got a preview of that Waste Management Phoenix Open from our resident golf handicapper, James Mazzola. We have a plethora of prop betting articles for you. A lot of individual player props, team and game props, novelty props. I put up some stuff on the MVP today. So many prop articles over at bangthebook.com. Make sure you check them out. But it's not just NFL. It's not just golf for us. College basketball and NBA every day. Parker Michaels' daily NHL picks. We've got soccer previews, tennis previews, esports. NASCAR's not that far away. We got college basketball conference previews for the Big Ten and the Big East from Bang the Book Radio guest John Ryan. So much going on over there. Make sure you head on over there and check it all out. Finally, as you know, this and every edition of Bang the Book Radio presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook. BTB and the number 200 is that promo code. 100% deposit match bonus for the sportsbook. 100% deposit match bonus for the live casino at BetDSI. It's only a game until you bet it. And real quickly here, I want to mention today is hashtag Bell Let's Talk Day on social media. They donate 5 cents to help mental health initiatives every time you use the hashtag out on Twitter. I've mentioned this before. I've been very open about it. I talked to someone a few years ago for depression. It helped me tremendously. It didn't work talking to friends. It didn't work talking to family. So I went and talked to a trained professional to help me out. Maybe talking to friends will help you. Maybe talking to family will help you. Maybe it takes a trained professional. But do not let your mental health issues overwhelm you. Do not let them control you. Go out there and get some help. And on hashtag Bell Let's Talk Day, I just wanted to take a minute to mention that here on today's show. Our first guest, a good one, a longtime friend of ours. Haven't had him on the show for a few weeks and happy to have him back. That is professional handicapper Brian Leonard from WagerTalk.com. Brian, how's it going today, man?
Everything's going great, and I want to double up on your mental health thoughts. I've had some things happen in my life in the last decade or whatever, and I sought out help, and it put everything into perspective. And for somebody who gambles for a living and has to have a clear head, it's extremely important to be able to reach out and clear up any of those thoughts that are really troubling you. So I'm very big on the professional help. And also, as you mentioned, if you've got some really good friends, that also helps a lot. So you don't have to do this alone.
No, you definitely don't. You do not have to do this alone. And that's a very important thing to remember, that there are a lot of people out there willing to help you, a lot of people that care. And, it really doesn't matter what line of work you're in. These mental health issues can affect everybody. But, certainly when you do something for a living where it's, largely a bottom line business, it's a results-based business, it can be very difficult. And even if you only do this as a supplement or just something you do for fun, it can bring you down because, everybody wants to succeed at everything it is that they're doing. So it is very important to have that clear mind, that proper perspective. And I certainly thank you for sharing your own personal experiences and echoing those thoughts here on today's show. But Brian, the Super Bowl coming up here on Sunday, 2 weeks of talk and analysis and breakdowns about this game. We haven't had the chance to talk with you yet about this game, though. Kansas City won 1.5, total 54, 54.5. This moved shortly after the line came out, and it really hasn't moved since.
No, it hasn't. And I think the line's pretty correct. I haven't spoken to many people who have a huge edge one way or the other. it's about what I thought it was going to be. My feelings were whoever came out as the favorite, if it got to three, I'd play the dog. It's unfortunate that the line is so close to pick 'em that we're not going to have the traditional ability of playing the money line on the favorite, which is normally bet down. That's one of my automatic bets when we come to the Super Bowl. If you see a 10-point favorite, you know everybody's going to bet on the dog on the money line, and we're going to get value on that 10-point favorite. And it's going to be played down to as if it was a 7-point favorite. So, but we won't be able to use that one this year, but it should give us a better game here. Coming into this, you've got the defenses over, you know, since the Super Bowl has been around, defenses have really been the ones that have performed better in the playoffs, or excuse me, better from a point spread standpoint when it comes to the Super Bowl. But this Kansas City team could take advantage of some of the things that San Francisco has done. If you break down when San Francisco plays a quarterback that's mobile, they've been an average defense. They have not been nearly as strong as they have been. San Francisco is excellent on putting teams in third and long, just like the Kansas City defense is much better with putting teams in third and long. So I would expect, especially from the Kansas City side, to see a lot of passes on first and second down, so they don't have to be put into that third and long. And that's what really plays into the San Francisco defense. So I would tend to see more passing coming out of Kansas City, similar to what they did last game, where they started the game with a lot of passing. They may have had just six or so runs the first half. So I think that will work. Even though, you know, San Francisco's numbers overall from a passing standpoint, they're very good. But most of that is coming from third down. So just hit them on first and second down. I think that'll be the way to play. I think Kansas City's coaching staff knows their best player is their quarterback, and keep the ball in his hands. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see the quarterback do some running here. So I'm going to take a look at that. And and then on the other side of the ball, San Francisco should be able to run right down Kansas City's throat. I don't think that taking them off the field and keeping their offense off the field works. I believe Kansas City was number one in points this year, and they were one of the least amount of drives on the season. So, they just score so quickly. I think it's going to be an offensive game. The line is extremely high at 54.5 at this range, but that's the only thing I can look at right now. Maybe play, usually there's a feeling out period in the first half of the first game or first half of the first quarter. Maybe, if you want to get involved, wait until, halfway through the first quarter, and maybe we get a better number than that 54.5. Maybe we can get a fit under 51 would be great, and then play the over in live betting. But it's just something that I'm going to take a look at. I haven't done a lot with the props this year, but I'm going to take a look at more into live betting of the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I think the live betting thing makes a lot of sense. In particular, like you said, I mean, we're sitting here with a high total, but I've seen some people I respect take a similar mindset to you and say, well, maybe first half under, 26.5, 27. Maybe that first score doesn't come all that quickly. Maybe over 6.5 minutes into the first quarter for the first score. You do get that feeling out period. And again, I don't know how much this matters. I know we've kind of talked before about, Major League Baseball playoff experience and stuff like that. I don't think it really matters overall over the full sample size of the game. But there will be nerves early on in this game. I mean, you do have, Patrick Mahomes in the biggest game of his life. Jimmy Garoppolo has been around this prep period with New England for the Super Bowl, but it's not like he's ever really played in one. So we could get some high throws, some bad timing, some mistimed throws, stuff like that, to where maybe this game does start a little bit slow. So if you do think there are points, maybe you do get that better number, as you mentioned, over the course of the first quarter. But something I do want to hit on real quickly that you said, and this is always very interesting, that depressed favorite money line, because everyone wants to bet the favorite minus the points, the dog on the money line. We don't really have that opportunity this time around, as you said. So usually you do get, 15 or 20 cents shaved off of that favorite money line, and this time you don't. So I'll be kind of curious to see, how everything settles on Sunday right before kickoff in terms of, do people take Kansas City -1, -1.5, or do they just take that, you know, -125 money line?
Yeah, at that point, I think just laying the points is a little bit probably the way to go. I see that, you know, obviously the Kansas City quarterback, when you're taking a look at who's going to be the MVP, I've seen his numbers even slightly less than Kansas City winning. I don't think that's a good bet, only because you're only one player on the field, and I would rather lay the 10 cents or whatever to have your team win as opposed to having to worry about the quarterback. Let's say he throws two touchdown passes to the same guy. Maybe that receiver wins the MVP because of that. So if you're looking to play you know, the Kansas City quarterback as your Super Bowl MVP, I think I'd prefer having the team at Kansas City just on the money line, or even laying the point or the point and a half would probably be even a better sensible bet, I would think.
Yeah, and that reminds me of last year. You know, Julian Edelman became the first wide receiver in 10 years to win the Super Bowl MVP last year. But that was something that I talked about. Of, if you like New England, odds are Tom Brady probably wins the MVP. You get a better price on Brady to win the MVP than you did on New England to win the game on the money line last year. That's not the case here this year with this one. So, you know, again, it's always very interesting to sort of look at the correlations that are out there. And that brings us to the prop market, because there are some people that look at the prop market, Brian, and they load up on the same side that they've already bet for the game. Other people will have one side that they like for the game and kind of play their prop bets as sort of a quasi hedge of, you know, well, I like this side in the game, but, you know, maybe I like this player prop over, or, you know, maybe I like the other team to score first, something like that. What's sort of the prop strategy that you kind of look at?
Yeah, I do something different than the props than a lot of people do. You know, they call some people on a, you know, week-to-week basis board scrapers in Vegas. And those are the guys that come in if the line's one at a bunch of casinos, and all of a sudden in one casino it's two, they'll come in and they take the two. And they're not really gambling. They're more investing, knowing that they're getting a little bit of an advantage there. I don't do that during the regular season. I mean, it's, you've got to have so many outs. You've got to be able to have so much money lined up. I don't do it during the regular season, but I do it for the props. And so, you know, you mentioned if somebody likes Kansas City, they're playing all the Kansas City props over and that kind of thing, or maybe the San Francisco under. At that point, you might as well just take the side of the game that you like and just stick with that. I look for what the right number should be on all these props, and then I shop the value. If the line on the game on something should be, you know, will this player score a touchdown, and the true line is -150, if I can lay a -120, that's what I do. If I could take back a better number than what the true line is, I take that back. So I'm going into the Super Bowl, and I'm just looking, knowing that I've got the best of the number on all of these props. And that's the way I look at it. And, you know, it makes it really tough to root for somebody or root for a team in the game, because I don't know what the hell I've got. You know, when it comes down to it, I'll go over and I says, okay, I got this guy over three catches. Fine. I'll look at halftime and say, okay, he's over, that kind of thing. But it's hard to enjoy a Super Bowl doing what I do, but I don't care. I'm not in this to watch. And in fact, we even talked, I might not even watch the game. If I got something other better that comes up, I may do that. I don't need to watch the game. So, but I'm looking to catch the best of the number. And there's so many places out there right now that have props, and a lot of these places will do, they'll take one big bet on a prop and they'll just move that line from one side to the other and give you plenty of value on the other side. So you need to know, you have to go through and make out what you think the true number is on these props. And, that's what you go with. At least that's what I go with. And if you find value on that, we've seen this over the years, the alternative number props have always been, somebody screws those up and you get a great deal on that. Same with the alternative number for, you know, the totals. But there's so many things out there that you can really get the best of the number on. So I don't treat it like a lot of people do. Like you said, if you like Kansas City, they tend to go the overs on that. What I want to do, if I want to play any overs, usually I play those as soon as I can. Because you get a popular quarterback, his pass attempts are going to go up, his yardage is going to go up. You get down on that at the ground floor, then you come back at the end and play all of your unders. And I know guys that will have an entire card of unders on every prop day of the game, day before the game, knowing that the correct number should be catches at 3 -120. Well, it's now at -180. So they'll come back and they'll play the under in that. So it's something that I look at. It's more of a puzzle to me, trying to get the best spot on every bet I've got. And that's what I do for the Super Bowl. It's just getting a whole bunch of positive EV bets and knowing the public likes scoring, especially 54.5 right now. You know there's going to be a lot of people who, this guy's going to score a touchdown, that guy's going to score a touchdown. You just come in late and play them not to score the touchdown, under in yardage, and that's the way the professionals do it.
And that's the thing. You know, I mean, it's tough to root for a Super Bowl like that because you have a lot of unders, you have a lot of minus prices, you have a lot of, you know, no touchdown, no safety, no overtime, all the stuff that people like to play for the novelty element of it, the big plus prices. There's a reason why those are big plus prices. And the true odds are nowhere near what's out there in the marketplace in terms of a lot of those props. So, you know, that's the thing. I mean, you have to understand, and I don't mean you, I know that you understand this, but for our listeners out there, you have to have a clear idea of what you want to achieve with the Super Bowl. If you want to have fun with it, you're going to have, you know, some long shots for MVP. You're going to have some long shots for first touchdown, touchdown anytime, stuff like that. If you want to make money with the Super Bowl, you're probably going to have to take a lot of those heavily juiced bets, or as you said, take a lot of those plus EV plays where something is just mispriced because the books know where the money is going to come in. And is it the most exciting way to watch the Super Bowl? No, probably not. But, you know, all of us want the, you know, 35-31 shootout type game. The professionals want last year's 13-3 sleep fest. So, you know, again, try to figure out if you want to find a happy balance, that's perfectly fine. But again, keep in mind that if you're betting a lot of these big plus prices, a lot of long shots, you're probably losing a good bit of money on the Super Bowl.
Yeah, it's true. And you made a good point about the minuses and the pluses. I always say, go down your portfolio. If you've got more pluses than you have minuses, you're trying to have fun. You're probably not going to win, but you're trying to have fun. It's sort of like a guy playing the slot machine. He pulls on that thing and on the handle, and he knows the odds are against him, but he wants that one big payoff. And that's really what you're looking at. And, you know, we've seen this with the overtime the last few years, the last decade or so. You look over the NFL for a regular season. During a week, there's probably roughly about a 16-1 chance of a game going to overtime. So you get like one overtime per week. Well, anymore, you know, because they've had overtimes in, I think, 3 out of 4 games in the last decade, people are just jumping on the overtime. Right now, I'm at Chris, and it's a plus 660. Well, the true line is a lot higher than that. Right now, you can lay 12-10 on the no, but once it gets down to, you know, minus 900 on the no, that's a hell of a bargain. So there's guys out there that will bet the no at that point. I used to do that all the time. You know, a lot of people have learned from it, but sure, it's happened in a small sample size, but anytime you're looking at a small sample size, you're not getting all the information. So you need to go over the entire, not only the history of the Super Bowl, but the history of games lined in this area and games lined overall in the NFL during every week. And you'll find that, you know, if you're taking plus 660, that's a bad bet. It could win, and it has won, but you don't want to have to depend on those kind of things on your portfolio.
No, and I mean, again, keep in mind, you know, the Super Bowl is generally a pretty close competitive game. This is the 54th Super Bowl. One has gone to overtime, and it took New England coming back from being down 28-3 to get there. Sorry to any Falcons fans that are listening here on today's show to open up that wound, but that was the first one to go to overtime. And again, it was a game that was very unlikely to go to overtime, with that 28-3 lead. So if you're out there betting overtime, and I get it, I understand why people want to do it, saying, well, look at the line for this game. It's basically a coin flip. Yeah, I understand that. But also, it's very, very, very rare for games to go to overtime, period, let alone go to overtime here in the Super Bowl. And part of that, too, and I wrote a big article today about Raheem Mostert and his chance of winning the MVP. You know, the last MVP as a running back was Terrell Davis in Super Bowl 32, as I mentioned on yesterday's show. You know, it's one of those things that's pretty rare. And going to overtime in the Super Bowl is extremely rare. Now, could it happen? Of course it could. But it's probably not going to. So, you know, you get suckered into some of these plays with these nice plus money prices and things like that. Keep in mind, there's a reason why that price looks so enticing. It's because it's very unlikely to happen.
Yeah, most of the people that are playing the Super Bowl, you've got your regular bettors that bet every week, but you also have your regular bettors' wives, mother-in-laws playing the games, and they want to play the plus prices. So let them pump up the plus prices for you, and you take some minus prices at better numbers than what they should be. And, you know, not everybody has that ability to do that. You have to have the bankroll to do it. But I know guys that make more money in the Super Bowl than they make all season long based off of those props. And they do put in their work. And, I've done it myself when I was a little bit younger. And these are 80-hour weeks where you're running from one casino to another. It's a little bit easier now because you've got all the apps. But then everybody has that same advantage. So it's a different game than it was just 5 years ago. You know, everybody has the offshores. You have your, if you live in Vegas, you've got your apps. You live in other states now and you've got your apps. So, you know, I know people that are, they'll fly into New Jersey just for the Super Bowl, just because they have different apps that they could play on during that time and try to get, you know, a plus 110 one way and a plus 120 the other way. And they're fine with that. And that's really how you build up your bankroll.
Well, and again, too, I mean, with this being the first really nationwide Super Bowl with 20 or so states that now have betting, you know, we've talked about this a little bit on the show, and you know this as well as I do. The line up in Reno and San Francisco is going to be different than it is in Vegas, is going to be different than it is in New Jersey. The prop bets are going to be the same way. You know, people aren't going to Reno to bet a bunch of Kansas City overs. They're betting San Francisco overs. They're supporting their team. It's going to be the same. You know, maybe you get, you know, a guy who's a local player that grew up in New Jersey or Philadelphia or something like that. People are going to bet his props to support that guy. So that line's going to be higher in New Jersey than it's going to be in Iowa or, you know, Indiana or something like that. So obviously not everybody has the ability to just, you know, hop around the country and play these different things, but we will get to that point eventually, and it will create so much value for astute plus EV bettors that are out there.
I agree.
All right, so let's talk some Major League Baseball here, because it is nice to talk something other than the Super Bowl, even though that is the biggest thing in town here. But Major League Baseball season win totals out earlier than ever before, as is often the case now with season win totals across all of the markets. I started my MLB betting guide much earlier than I ever have, going to get that done here in mid to late February or so. But I know you're starting to take a look at the Major League Baseball win totals. You've had two excellent baseball seasons in a row from a game, from a day-by-day standpoint. What's the starting point? What's the process look like for you in terms of starting to handicap these season win totals?
Yeah, before you get to what's going to happen this year, you have to give a review on what happened last year. Just because a team won 95 games last year does not mean they're a 95-win team. So you go to FanGraphs or one of these other sites that are excellent in baseball, and that's what they do. And you break it down as to, you know, how many runs they scored as opposed to how many they gave up. You got to take a look at what their lineups were. Were they healthy? You know, take a look at the Yankees season last year. For what the Yankees did, considering all the injuries they had last year, and then they add players for this year, including probably the best pitcher in Major League Baseball, one of the top three at least. I mean, you got to think the Yankees are a team that's going to be tough to beat. And coming from Cleveland, I hate to say that, but you have to take a look at how many, you know, check out the projected WAR from last year. If you would have the players from last year compared to this year, you want to look at the adjustments on, you know, not just what the player did last year, but maybe what he's done this last 3 or 4 years, and figure out what he was worth overall last year. And, you know, did he get his 700 at bats like he normally would be, or was he limited to 400? And then you take the other 300 at bats at that position. You say, okay, what happened there, and what do they have this year? So you combine it a little bit. Joe Pita did an excellent book a few years ago on it, Trading Bases, and he talked about how he does these things. I've had a chance to talk to Joe a few times, just a brilliant mind when it comes to this. And so you compare, you finish your season with what the team should have won, compare it to what the players have been brought in now, and the coaching staff and everything that's going on now, and you compare the two, and then that's how you decide on if you think you've got some value or not. You know, we're both Cleveland Indians fans. I don't have high hopes for the Indians. I mean, they've got a lot of no-name players. If they don't get off to the best start, they've got some guys that obviously they're looking to trade. That's a concern. Anymore, you have your haves and the have-nots, and you have to take a look at the baseball teams and look at, say, okay, this team is a fringe playoff team. What happens if these players get injured? The rookies that they're trying to bring up don't come through like they have. Will they be able to go out and trade for better players? Will they go out and build this team up? Well, you know, certain teams, the Indians aren't going to do that. The Indians are not one of those teams that has the money to do that. There's certain other teams that do have them. And the Dodgers every year, they can do whatever they want. They could be in last place and still make the playoffs because of the money that they have. They won't be. They're so loaded. But they're so loaded in the minors that they could have these guys that are one step away from making the majors, trade them for an all-star player. I mean, look at Mookie Betts out there right now, one of the best players in all of baseball, and the Red Sox are trying to trade him. So that's something you have to worry about, is how long will these star players on these teams remain there? And we saw that with Starling Marte just this week, going from the Pirates to Arizona. He was one of their best players, and from a Pirate standpoint, you have to look at that and say, you know what? It looks like they've given up on the season already.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I do really like the Diamondbacks for this season, by the way. But, you know, with something like the Indians, for example, you know, they won 93 games last year, the most wins ever to get shut out of the wild card game since the wild card game started in 2012. And Lindor and Ramirez were not healthy most of the year. Lindor was not healthy early on. Had a terrible September that dragged his numbers down a little bit. Ramirez was hurt twice, had the broken hamate, was also banged up early on in the year. And then, you know, they lost Mike Clevinger for 2 months. They lost Corey Kluber for almost all season. I know that they've traded him since, but, you know, Carlos Carrasco got leukemia. I mean, you know, the Indians won 93 games and had all these things go wrong. So you weigh that. But then you also weigh the fact that, well, if you look at base runs over at FanGraphs, and you look at third order win percentage over at Baseball Prospectus, they overachieved last season. They were more like an 88 win team. So how do you factor all of that into the equation? That's how you come up with your thoughts here for these season win totals. And one other very important one, and I see people, I will admit I'm falling in line with the Reds. I already played their season win total over 83.5. I do like them. I don't like the White Sox as much, but these teams that win the offseason, these teams that spend money, that make trades, that go out and actively get better, their perception is very inflated coming into the season, whereas the teams that didn't do anything, like a team like the Indians, people are very pessimistic about. People are very low on the Chicago Cubs going into the season because they haven't really done anything. Be very mindful and be very careful of that, you know, you don't win, you do add wins, at least on paper, in the offseason. It doesn't always translate to the actual results, and people really lose sight of that, you know, here in January and February.
Yeah, I agree. And I do actually kind of like the White Sox. I think they're going to be very competitive. They didn't give up any of their key minor league guys or their young guys that are in the starting stage of really becoming a good player. So I don't know if the pitching is going to be there for the White Sox, but that everyday lineup's much better than it has been. But yeah, the Cincinnati Reds are a team that is on the uptick, but you've got to pay extra for that. So that's why you have to go through and compare everything year to year. And you talked about all the injuries with the Indians, but the Indians also had a lot of guys that maybe they didn't have career years, but they had years better than what you expected. And, you know, I look down across that team and the infield's great. I mean, I love the Indians infield. I love the bullpen. I love the starters. But once again, I have problems with that outfield, and it was the same thing was last year. I thought that was one of the worst outfields to ever start the season in Major League Baseball. At least they have a center fielder this year. But other than that, I have concerns with the Indians. And like I said, they're not a team that's going to go out and try to improve as the season goes on. I don't know how long Lindor's going to be on the team. That concerns me. And anymore, you have teams, like I said, they're either in it to win it, or they're in there to tank. And we've seen how that's gone. And, you know, obviously, if you've got a team that's a fringe team, they could be a team that gives it all up in the second half of the season and brings up a lot of minor leaguers and it starts getting some playing time for them. So if you're looking to bet some of these lesser teams, it's tougher to play the overs on them because I know, you know, you see a Baltimore or a Kansas City or one of those teams with such a low number, and they're really not playing in, they're not playing in the American League East where you've got four or five teams that are really good. It's going to be tough to play those over. And so that's some of the things you got to look at. But there's value out there in these season wins, and especially if you're willing to come to Vegas or any of the other states and put up cash as opposed to playing it on a credit shop. I mean, you're always going to get a better number putting up cash. But keep in mind that cash is gone for 8 or 9 months.
One last thing I want to ask you about here, and then we'll stop with this segment. We have plenty of time to talk baseball, obviously, in the lead up to the season. But this whole Astros fallout from the sign stealing scandal, and obviously this had, you know, impacts with teams like the Red Sox and the Mets as well, though I think the Mets still did very well with their managerial hire. A lot of people have different opinions about the Astros now going into this season. Some will say that, you know, this will impact them negatively, that they're going to get every team's best shot throughout all 162 games because players and teams around the league are pissed. They're pissed off at, you know, the implications of this, both financially and also what it meant for some of these players, you know, maybe getting sent down because they weren't able to pitch well against the Astros, stuff like that. On the other hand, this is now a very much us against the world mentality for the Astros. And we've seen that with all the sound bites we've had. There is no remorse from that team whatsoever, from the individual players that participated in this. So any idea how you're going to kind of look at the Astros for the upcoming season?
Yeah, it's really tough. And, you know, the Astros got caught. You can't tell me the other teams in baseball haven't done the same things. Maybe not to the same extent, but you're all trying to win. Is it right? Is it, you know, is it something that should have been done? Every team is out there trying to win. So they may have taken it a step too far, but, you know, I'm upset about the Astros. You know, the Indians got beaten in the playoffs a couple of years ago. I mean, if you're some of these teams, sure, you're upset about the Astros, but you're right. You get players who, you know, quality players, Bregman and Altuve, where people have come out and, you know, basically called them cheaters and the whole bit. These have been guys who were good in the minors. They've been good their entire careers. Bregman's a little bit younger, but these are good ball players. And all it takes sometimes is a little bit of motivation. And so I expect Houston to be just as good as they've been in the past. Obviously, losing Cole has an effect on them, but they've been a good team for a long time. They got good play. They still have good players. You know, it's not like you could try harder in baseball. It's not like football or basketball, where you could try harder and physically impose over somebody. In baseball, it's more of a finesse game. You know, you can't, if you throw the ball harder, you're going to miss the strike zone. If you try to swing too hard, you're going to miss the ball. So anytime any of this stuff comes out, when it comes down to other sports compared to baseball, I think it has less significance in baseball.
Brian Leonard, professional handicapper over at wagertalk.com. Good to get you back on the show here, man. Good to talk some stuff about the Super Bowl and Major League Baseball. And again, we will be doing a lot of Major League Baseball stuff as we go forward here. But what's up right now over at Wager Talk, man?
It's going good over at Wager Talk. I've been very selective as of late. Had hockey plays the last two nights, won them both underdog plays. But I did have a nice play up today in baseball, or excuse me, in college basketball, a 5% play. And I haven't had a 5% since, back in December 29th. I think I had the Ravens. And the Ravens, and that was my last one. So it's been a month since I've had a 5% play, and they come with 150% guarantee. If the play doesn't win, you get 150% of the money you spent on it back into your account. So this is a rare big play for me, and I don't put out a lot of them. And we've done very well on these over the years. And I'm a big player, big time player, but I'm not going to force anything. So if you've joined us today and you want to get a college basketball play, is one I really like a lot on today's card.
Well, man, of course, make sure you follow Brian on Twitter as well, at @BLeonardSports. Brian Leonard, professional handicapper over at wagertalk.com. Great to chat with you again, man. Missed having you on the show, and look forward to talking with you again next week.
Sounds great, and I hope everybody has a profitable Super Bowl. And remember, it's just one game. Don't go in over your head.
There you go. There's Brian Leonard, professional handicapper over at wagertalk.com, and once again, at @BLeonardSports on Twitter. We got one more guest, one more segment here for this Wednesday edition of the show. That is Wes Reynolds, at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter, host on VSiN and contributor to the Point Spread Weekly Newsletter. Wes, how's it going today, man?
Hey, Adam. I know this is the most exciting time of the year, but I'm about ready for this game to be played, and let's get this game over, right?
I am definitely ready for this game to be played. I got a lot of my props already squared away. I got my smaller positions on the game. I'm just ready for this thing to get going, and we still have four full days until this game actually gets underway here. But we will talk about Super Bowl 54. Also talk some golf stuff with Wes on this segment. But Wes, when we last talked a week ago, Kansas City -1, -1.5, total 54, 54 and a half. Nothing new to report really on either end for that.
Yeah. And of course, obviously the bulk of the money is going to come in as you get closer to game time. As people get in, I think probably Thursday is when you start seeing some people come into town, and then into Friday, Saturday, and then of course game day. Obviously it's one of those things where you can't necessarily wait to the last minute either to see if you're going to try, and you're not going to get to extract the most amount of line value just waiting until right before kickoff like you would on a normal week. But yeah, most of the money is going to start coming in later into the week, and then I think from a total standpoint, from a side standpoint, the max that this will go to is Kansas City -2. I don't know if San Francisco, if enough money will have them become the favorite. And talking with Jeff Sherman over at Westgate Superbook USA yesterday, he could see it maybe going to pick. He doesn't see 49ers favorite showing, at least market-wide or across the board, maybe one place or so. But in terms of the total, it's kind of, you know, stuck there at 55. You did see some initial buyback when some shops went to 55, but it's one of those things, the people that are coming into town to bet the game, they're not coming into town. And I was talking with Patrick Everson at Covers about this, they're not coming into town necessarily to bet the under, you know what I mean? I don't know if this is going to reach the highs of the 57s or the 56s and a halves that we thought it might in terms of like the first couple of days of betting. We're like, man, this thing's going to keep rising and rising. But when it gets to 55, 55 and a half, that's probably when you get the buyback. But that's what I think underbackers are still waiting, because they know that they might get a half point or a point more than the current total right now.
Yeah, I think that we will see that sharp money on the under that you're talking about that we've kind of been waiting on and sort of forecasting here. What I'm really curious to find out is what emerges as the sharp side for the game. I know that initially we had a little bit of quant money kind of come in on Kansas City a little bit, kind of grabbing some of the pick'ems or minus ones that were out there. Saw a little bit of buyback kind of pull it back down to, you know, -1, -115, stuff like that. But I don't think we've seen a true sharp side emerge for the spread yet. Obviously, we've got, you know, some money on San Francisco money line. People are mostly laying the minus one with Kansas City if they like them. But I think it remains to be seen what the sharp side will be from a side standpoint. Or we could see two-way sharp action on both sides here, because you've got San Francisco with the better defense, Kansas City with the better passing game, and we all know, you know, what the passing game means in today's NFL. I don't really see this side moving much, and I don't see a well-defined sharp side or a sharp versus public split here.
Yeah, I really don't either, to be honest with you, because I think it's going to be, as you lump different types of bettors into these little subcategories, you're going to have casual bettors on Kansas City. You're going to have casual bettors on San Francisco. You're going to have professional bettors on Kansas City. You're going to have professional bettors on San Francisco. So exactly what you said there. I mean, I don't think that there is a clear consensus, I guess, what the sharp play is. I even think when you look, and one of the things I'm always interested in terms of the Super Bowl coverage, even though I don't watch it nonstop because it's like 2 weeks of stuff talking about the same thing, I like to monitor kind of what the media opinion is. Not necessarily that I'm going to follow it. More often than not, I'm going to go against it. But I like to monitor that opinion and kind of see that, because sometimes media opinion, especially for a big game like this, is going to shape general public opinion. And they're going to listen to all the stuff that they see on the big television networks and listen to on the radio and see in terms of what's being written about or talked about. So you've really seen, and we talked to a gentleman that was a producer on the NFL Network morning show the other night, and he said, look, all the opinion, and we've been talking about this game for over a week, obviously being the NFL Network, the opinion's been pretty split. It hasn't been really one side or the other, and it is usually more defined on one side or the other. Not that it's always like 80-20 or 90-10, but you know, you'll at least get like a 60-40 or a 2/3, 1/3 on one side or the other. And you really don't have that yet for this game, and it probably won't emerge.
Yeah, I don't think so. And as we transition over to taking a look at the prop side of things here too, as we talked about last week, kind of introing the prop stuff, as we've kind of talked about throughout the week here, I think this is a difficult one for props, because you've got a Kansas City offense that can spread it around, a San Francisco offense that maybe can win this game being one-dimensional with the running game and Raheem Mostert, but maybe can't, maybe needs Jimmy Garoppolo a little bit more. Is it George Kittle? Do they have to find somebody else like Emmanuel Sanders, like Deebo Samuel? You know, does Tevin Coleman actually wind up playing in this game? I think this prop betting market is difficult too, because you have the contrast of styles, you have a lot of options for the Chiefs, and maybe more options than we think for the 49ers. Two brilliant play callers, two brilliant play designers. Andy Reid, very good off the bye to the under, as we know. So maybe that kind of holds down San Francisco's offense some. I've had to be very creative, I think, with my prop approach here. What about you?
Yeah, I'm the same way. And I think, look, some of the prop stuff, depending on how much you delve into it, you're obviously going to try to do middles and the like, and see if somebody kind of puts out a bad number. Like, I know a lot of people, well, I'll give you an example, like Raheem Mostert's rushing yards. I think this was a couple of days ago at MGM Properties. It was around 60 and a half or so juice to the over. And then at FanDuel, it was like 77 juice to the under. So, yeah, you're going to try to work a middle when there's 16 yards and stuff in terms of a discrepancy there. But props to me are kind of a combination of some guys, the real numbers guys, do it with all analytics. And that's all that they do is do numbers. I think it's got to be a little bit of a combination of both. It's got to be a combination of numbers and really examining the stats and the metrics over the season. But it's also got to be a little bit of your gut when it's such a close spread like it is here in Super Bowl 54. So that's what kind of led me. I've played a couple, and I've waited for them to drop a little bit. I did play a couple, not really huge. I played a couple overs, actually, with Jimmy Garoppolo in terms of passing, in terms of completions especially, or in pass attempts. Not necessarily yards, but I went a little bit against the grain because people do like to bet what they see last. And they saw Jimmy Garoppolo throw 8 passes. That literally almost tied almost a 50-year-old record. I think it was Bob Greasy in December of 1973 had 6 passes in the AFC Championship game. Jimmy Garoppolo ended up with 8. I think it's the fewest by a winning team in a conference championship game since that Greasy game in 1973. So, of course, people think, well, Jimmy Garoppolo is only going to throw like maybe 10 to 12 times or something in this game. I don't think that's the case at all. And I don't think that that was a sign necessarily that Kyle Shanahan was babying Jimmy Garoppolo. I think they found something that was working. They found that Green Bay couldn't stop the running game, and it's that old, I'm going to run it until you stop it. And Green Bay never really found a way to stop it until it was too late. And then San Francisco is basically just like running out the clock and running pretty conservative because they didn't have to throw the ball. So why throw it if you don't have to? But I think that they're probably going to have to in spots in this game. Yeah, they like to run the ball, but of course Kansas City's going to key it on the run. So that's going to force the quarterback to make plays down the field. So I bet some Garoppolo overs. I also bet some Damian Williams overs in terms of his rushing yards. That's the Kansas City running back. He averaged in the 2 playoff games like a 90% snap rate and got about 90% of the targets out of the backfield. So the Mahomes rushing over prop has been bad. Some sharp guys have given that out. So that means that, of course, has risen. But I think you're going to see Williams have to run the ball a little bit more. And I do think Kansas City will run the ball because that 49ers front four is so fast up front that you got to hit them with some quick hitters. You got to hit them with some draws and some counters. So I would expect Kansas City to run the ball a little bit more than is anticipated.
Yeah, I like that one too. You know, I kind of looked at it as, you know, Williams over – I think it was 81.5 rushing and receiving yards is one that I took a look at here for this one. Because, again, I mean, I do think that, you know, this is a situation where you probably are going to get a lot of Damian Williams. You know, I mean, it's sort of like maybe you kind of take that James White-esque approach if you're Andy Reid here and, you know, use him as a runner, use him as a receiver, try to slow down that front four. Because ultimately it's going to give Patrick Mahomes more time in the pocket too. And maybe Mahomes is better on the move, but you know, you certainly want to give Mahomes every opportunity possible to get very comfortable in this game, in particular because you are off of a 2-week layoff here where timing could be a little bit of a factor. So, again, you try to think of game flow. You try to put yourself in the minds of these head coaches, of their coordinators, try to figure out what they're going to look to do, who's going to match up on who. I think there are a lot of good opportunities here for some of those more, you know, next level game planning types of props. I think if you want to isolate one or two different guys outside of maybe like a Damian Williams, something like that, I think it's very hard in this game.
Yeah. And I think that's probably the way you want to approach it is just to target a couple players. If from the player prop standpoint is to really target a couple players and see if you can find some edges when you get into the advanced stuff of maybe the second and third unit guys, because look, the quarterback props are always going to draw the most Mahomes. And, there's going to be a lot of Mahomes overplay in the market just in general. So it's the same thing that the books are going to root for every year, even though this Super Bowl is priced more even, they're going to be rooting for a lot of unders on these props. And that's what they're going to do. So you see the same pattern from kind of the quote-unquote sharper guys that are betting these props. I mean, they're going to be betting unders, and books are going to need more unders than overs.
Now, something that I took a really long look at here, and I want to pick your brain about this because I thought it was pretty interesting. I wrote a pretty good article, at least in my estimation, about Raheem Mostert and his chances to win the MVP here in this game. He's generally anywhere in the 5.5 to 6 to 1 range. But it's been over 20 years since a running back won the MVP here. And it's funny because as I was going through, Marshawn Lynch would have won it in Super Bowl 49 if he runs in that final touchdown. He had the stats, had the stat line, but the Patriots wound up winning the game. So then, of course, you know, Tom Brady winds up winning the MVP. But it would have been Lynch. Outside of that, if you go up and down the Super Bowls here, there aren't a lot of cases for a running back to win it. So maybe there is something of an anti-running back bias, but also a lot of these teams that play in the Super Bowl have world-class quarterbacks, and they put it in the hands of those guys here. So Mostert at about 6-1 is interesting to me, because I think if San Francisco wins this game, he's the most likely guy to get the MVP, but also you're bucking a historical drought here of more than 20 years. So I thought that was a really interesting side plot to this game.
Yeah, you really are bucking a trend, because it reminds me, and it's been so long ago, even though I'm a fan of this team, I forget the number of the Super Bowl, but you remember the Super Bowl in Miami where the Colts played the Bears, and remember that it rained in the second half, which always makes me think in terms of a Super Bowl in Miami, never believe the weather forecast, because you always get that late afternoon shower, especially people that bet Gulfstream Park down there for horse racing know what I'm talking about. You always get that shower late in the afternoon. But if you remember that Colts-Bears game, Peyton Manning ended up winning the MVP. Now, it's because Peyton Manning was one of the biggest stars in the league, and he finally won the big one. So that's why he got the MVP. But if you looked at the stat line, the guy that probably should have won the MVP that year for the Colts is Dominic Rhodes for the Super Bowl game, who really was the guy that ran the ball real well in the second half and kind of kept the Bears at bay, but Rhodes didn't get the award. Peyton Manning did. And I think last year when you looked at that, Tom Brady didn't get the MVP and it was Julian Edelman, it was probably because Brady, because that's how voters, when they're voting, the media guys in the booth are going to think like that. They're going to be like, well, he's already won this a couple times, you know, let's give it to somebody else. And I thought Edelman was plenty deserving with all the stats that he put up for the game, but they could have put it to Brady. And I talked about this a little bit during the week in terms of voting for receivers for MVP. That's a little difficult to do, because let's say Travis Kelce catches 9 passes and 3 of them are touchdowns. Well, more often than not, that's probably going to mean that Mahomes is going to throw for 4 or 5 touchdowns and Kelce's catching 3 of them. So then they're going to lean a little bit to Mahomes getting the MVP instead of necessarily the receiver. And that's why you see these prices, these short prices for quarterbacks, because if I was liking more of the Kansas City side, I would have thought Damian Williams had at least a decent number value down there in the mid-teens to win the MVP. But it's so hard. I think that's one of the bets that generates the most handle in terms of a prop or an index prop, but it's one of the hardest because you don't get a lot of value, and there's a reason why the quarterbacks are plus 150, 2-1 or 3-1 to win this award.
Right. And I even went all the way back to 1990 when Joe Montana won it. I included Joe Montana in that. 17 of the last 30 have gone to quarterbacks. 6 of them have gone to defensive players.
Exactly.
So there've only been go ahead.
I think, well, I was just going to say, sorry to interject there, I think that's where maybe some of the value is on defensive players. I mean, we've seen the Larry Browns win the MVP, you know, if guys get multiple interceptions. So I'm sure if you look at someplace like Circus Sports where they've got 90 players listed to win the MVP, I'm sure they've got a fair amount of tickets on somebody like Richard Sherman, or they've got a fair amount of tickets on somebody like a Quan Alexander or a Nick Bosa or somebody like that.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, 6 defensive players, only 7 running backs and wide receivers combined. And, you know, Edelman last year broke a 10-year drought for wide receivers. So running backs haven't done it in over 20 years. It was 10 years between wide receivers. It was Santonio Holmes in 09, Edelman last year. I mean, you know, what can you really do with the MVP market? I mean, if Kansas City wins, it's very likely to be Patrick Mahomes. And by the way, a tight end has never won it. So Travis Kelce and George Kittle would have to make history here if they were to do it.
And so, you're thinking, if Rob Gronkowski never won it, then who's going to win it, right?
Right. Yeah, that's another excellent point. So I don't know. You know, I was kind of looking at that from a San Francisco standpoint. I mean, how many people are going to expect Jimmy G to do enough to win the MVP here? Not many. You know, if San Francisco wins, does it have to be Mostert? Is it somebody on defense where Patrick Mahomes actually takes really, really good care of the football? I think it's tough. And maybe that factors into the handicap of the game a little bit. If you don't think Mostert can win the MVP, and you know, running backs, again, haven't done it very often, what's the path to victory here for San Francisco? And that's not to say that I'm all about Kansas City. It's just, you know, with all the time you have to think about this game, you kind of think about these different angles.
Yeah, and I think that the fact, and one of the reasons I'm not playing for MVP, but one of the reasons I played some of the Jimmy G's overs is because, look, if this game does go over, that's, you know, you got to think that, and the 49ers, I think, average around 30 points a game. So this is a team, contrary to popular belief, that can score as well. And they've proven that they can win shootouts. They proved it in New Orleans that they could absolutely win shootout. Now, they were very balanced, but Jimmy G threw, I think four touchdowns in that game. And close to 300 yards. So he's fully capable of putting up big stats, even though he hasn't shown it in the playoffs.
And a couple other ones here, just that I kind of pulled from the article. You know, Super Bowl 50, C.J. Anderson, 90 yards. He didn't have it on 23 carries, so the yards per carry wasn't great. But that game had two offensive touchdowns. He had one of them. Didn't get it. It went to Von Miller. Super Bowl 51, I know Brady threw for 466 and had the big comeback and all that. But James White had 139 all-purpose yards and three touchdowns. Didn't get it. That Super Bowl you referenced with the Colts, Super Bowl 41, Dominic Rhodes, 21 carries, 113, and a touchdown. Did have one catch for 8 yards. Joseph Addai actually had 133 all-purpose yards in that game. 143 in that game himself. So kind of took away some of the yards from Rhodes there. Maybe would have had a different outcome. But like you said, you know, Peyton Manning. I mean, you know, is Raheem Mostert a star in the NFL? No. If they can give it to a star, are they probably going to do that? You know, you would think so. I don't know. I think it's a very interesting discussion. And, you know, again, just with so much to talk about here with regards to the Super Bowl, something I think was worth mentioning here on today's segment. But Wes, before we transition over to golf, any other specific props you want to mention here on the show?
Yeah, there's always a couple that I play most every year that really don't have a lot of statistical or analytical backing, but just want some that I always play. I always play Will there be a roughing the passer? And I usually will play the yes, because obviously they're protecting quarterbacks more than they really ever have done. So I usually do that. I usually do the no on the first 6.5 minutes of the game. This is a little bit tough to do with such a high total and a higher than expected or than what would be normal scoring game. But I always believe, and we did see it in the college football playoff where they did not score very early. Now there ended up being, I think it ended up landing 67. So kind of right in the middle where the number, right around where the number was. But sometimes you get that old rest versus rust question in terms of maybe they're going to be a little bit shaky. And if San Francisco, let's say they get the ball first and don't end up scoring, but run 4 or 5 minutes off the clock, well, then you're very close to that 6.5. So it is a little bit of a small plus on the no for the first 6.5. I may end up playing it just because it's kind of a creature of habit. I think in my prop portfolio, when I do, I probably end up with like only 10 to 15 props or something, you know, something that's kind of a moderate amount, I would say, in comparison. But there's usually those couple that I always play in terms of that. I don't really play a lot of the lottery ticket props. I do play defensive or special teams touchdown more often than not. I don't know if I'm going to do that yet. Those are kind of ones I decide over the weekend whether I'm going to do or not. So I usually play that, or I usually play like the sacks prop. I think those index props, a lot of prop bettors most years are just kind of going to play what they usually play on force of habit. And if they've cashed more tickets than they haven't, like with me, with that no score in the first 6.5 minutes or score in the final 2 minutes of the first half, you know, usually you display those just to, as being creatures of habit.
All right, so we switch gears over to the golf stuff here, and we start with a listener question that was presented to us for yesterday's show with Brian Blessing, but I think it's good to talk about with you here as well, Wes. This one from at PK73952 on Twitter said, they would like to hear more about golf betting strategies. If you just, you know, we talk about a list of guys that we'd like to win the tournament at good prices here, but are those guys that you also play in head-to-head matchups?
Sometimes, yeah, I mean, when they're correlated, yeah, sometimes I will do that. Not necessarily. I mean, sometimes you'll just find a good price in terms of a matchup of a guy that maybe you don't expect to win, but maybe it's a guy that you're picking on and that you think, hey, they're not 100% or they're just coming back from an injury or coming back from a long layoff. So there's some that you just use for matchup purposes for that. But more often than not, at least a couple matchup plays, if I play maybe four or five a week for a tournament matchup, more often than not, at least two of them are going to involve somebody that I've used on the futures market.
And then also a second question to that point about bankroll management and about, you know, sort of how you come to what you're putting on, you know, these outright picks at the much longer odds. Are you just betting, you know, a normal unit size on the head-to-head matchups? How do you sort of break that all down with your golf bankroll?
Yeah, with futures, what I break down, I try to kind of even out what the payout would be more often than not. I mean, certain weeks I'll like a middle price guy, maybe a little bit stronger, but usually I'm going to bet more on the 20-to-1 shot than if I'm betting, let's say, a 25-to-1 shot, then I'm probably going to go half of that on a 50 unit or above shot. That just kind of by default, it varies from week to week, but that's what I do. And what I've been doing a lot more this year with a little bit of success. Now, unfortunately in Las Vegas, these aren't offered unless it's a really big tournament, like a major or a WGC or something like that, where I've been betting a little bit more, allocating my money not only for something for the actual future for the outright win, but I've also been playing top five and top 10 because I haven't gotten the first place winner yet here in the first month, but I've hit some decent sized prices with top 10s with guys like Tom Hogue, who I've hit the last couple weeks, who, when you looked at the outright, was 175-to-1, 200-to-1 the week before at the Bob Hope and ended up top 10 the last 2 weeks. So you're still making money because of the fact that, look, here in the States and also here in Nevada, they don't offer the each-way betting that they offer in the UK or maybe some of our friends up in Canada that listen have those with some of their shops. And I wish they would do it. I think it would generate more interest in golf betting, but that's kind of your other way if you want to bet each way betting and you maybe have an offshore or faraway place account where they're going to offer more top fives, top tens, top 20s and stuff like that.
All right. So as we take a look here this week, one of my favorite golf tournaments, this one's on the bucket list to make it out to this one and kind of hang out and, you know, drink all day and watch golf like pretty much everybody else does at this tournament. The Waste Management Phoenix Open down at TPC Scottsdale. First and foremost, what kind of course are we looking at here? What types of players did you try to key in on?
Yeah, this is a Tom Weisskopf design, which he also designed the North course at Torrey Pines. But this is a little bit harder of a course. They've lengthened it a little bit. They've obviously resurfaced some of the greens. So the scoring isn't what it had been, because if you recall, I think it was back in 2013, Phil Mickelson shot 28 under over 4 days, 256, because this is a par 71. And the scoring the last several years has been 16 under, 15 under, 14, 17, 18, and 17. So you're going to get high teens. It's probably going to be the score. Maybe it eclipses 20 under, depending on the weather, if there's really no wind out there or anything, or if they might get a brief shower out there in Scottsdale to soften up the course. But usually guys that I look at in terms of metrics, greens and regulation is important pretty much every single week. If you look at the last five winners, the worst ranking of the last five winners was Ricky Fowler, and he was 13th in the field in greens and regulation. Obviously, the 2 years Matsuyama won, he was first and second. Woodland was fourth in the field. Koepka was fourth in the field that week in GIR. And then strokes gained approach, strokes gained tee to green. Ricky was the ultimate outlier when I was kind of looking at the statistics over recent years. Ricky won this tournament last year because he's number one in strokes gained putting. And sometimes you're going to get those weeks where a guy just puts the hell out of the ball and makes everything, because he was like 17th and 19th, which isn't bad, but usually is not the recipe for a winner here in terms of strokes gained approach and a tee to green. You looked at Woodland back in 2018, he was second in the field in both those categories. Matsuyama the year before was first. So obviously you got to hit good approaches, and you have to keep it in play. It's played at altitude, but it only travels about 2% longer in terms of a ball flight. You got relatively fast greens. It's Bermuda pretty much throughout the course. The back nine, especially the last four holes, is where you're going to see a lot of the fluctuation, because you got that reachable par five on 15. Then you've got, of course, the famous hole. The 16th is the amphitheater, where everybody is, you know, all the people from ASU that come to this, and all the fans are fairly intoxicated, and they're cheering good shots, booing bad shots. That's the par three. And then you get to a drivable par four at 17, just a little bit over 300 yards. So some guys are going to play it conservative. Some guys are going to go for it and try to reach the green and one, and then be putting for eagle on the par four. And then 18 is a longer par four. It's got water down the entire side, a lot of deep bunkers. So you will see some up and down fluctuations in terms of the last four holes, which makes this an exciting event. But I mean, by and large, I want guys that are good tee to green and guys that are good on the approaches. And Matsuyama, who I did end up playing this week, and God, I've thrown so much money down that hole. But this is a course where his poor putting by tour standards, I think, can get offset by his ball striking. Because this isn't an event where it's like, okay, you've got to necessarily make everything. If the ball striking's good, you're going to get enough opportunities.
Yeah, Matsuyama, the shortest price guy that you played here, you got him at 16-1. Obviously, shop around for the best prices that are out there. Most of his price is a little bit lower here at this point in time. But who else is on your card here this week for Scottsdale?
Well, one guy I really like, and it's he's got a little bit of a mixed bag here, but he has had success here despite not having a win, and that was Bubba Watson. And Bubba Watson, I think when people look at that, they're like, oh, man, he's kind of a little bit ill and hot-tempered. So maybe these crowds at Phoenix are going to get him off his game. But he's also a guy when he's going well that plays off the crowd and feeds off the crowd. Back-to-back runner-ups here in 2014 and 2015. He's got five top five, or he's got top five finishes here in a couple other years, including last year where he was fourth. He was a guy that stood out to me because he very quietly last week was sixth at Torrey Pines. He shot 67, 69, 69 on the south course, which is the more difficult course. He actually shot one over par on the easier course, which was that Weisskopf North course, where you saw guys like Ryan Palmer shooting 10 under on that course last week. And you look at the metrics and just the stats last week, he was third in strokes gained off the tee. He was sixth in strokes gained approach. He was second in greens and regulation. He was first in tee to green last week in San Diego. So this is a guy, I think that he will like this course. And I got him in, you can get him really in the mid-30s, I think, still right now. So I think he's the guy to look at. Brandon Grace, who actually finished second last year when he was totally out of form. Grace won his first event in a little over 2 years. He won the South African Open. So in January, so I think he's got a lot of confidence. Benny Ahn is another guy that has historically played pretty solid here at 90-1. Chez Reavie, almost triple digits at most books. He actually lives in Scottsdale, and he was fourth and second here the last 2 years. Was second on the tour last season in proximity to the hole. That's another statistic that will kind of matter this week, because obviously the closer the hole, the more chances you're going to have at birdie. And then a couple other triple digit guys, Max Homa, 100-1, Daniel Berger at around that range, 11th or better in three of his five appearances here. So I went a little bit off the beaten path and didn't necessarily go with the John Rahms or the Justin Thomases, but they're favorites, obviously, for very good reason.
Wes Reynolds, who's working and fun on Twitter, at Wes Reynolds and the number one. Just a guess here, man. I presume it's pretty busy over at VSiN this week.
It is, and I'm kind of moving around. I'm like the utility infielder, the Luis Oquendo, I feel like, if you will, somebody that moves across the diamond. So doing a couple shows during the day this week, and then the normal green zone slots, because we have different programming that specialize for Super Bowl. So I will be on at various times all over the weekend, and then doing the Sunday night kind of late night autopsy at 11 p.m. Pacific. We're the last show that 24th hour in terms, because we're doing a 24-hour programming for Super Bowl Sunday. And myself and Danny Burke will be the last hour of that programming on Sunday, but I'm also on it other various times. So thanks to everybody that listens and for all the support of VSiN. I'll be on at some random points during the day when you tune in.
Well, like I said, make sure you follow Wes on Twitter, at Wes Reynolds and the number one. Wes, always a pleasure, man. Thank you so much for joining me. Good luck with all your Super Bowl stuff, and we'll talk to you again next week.
You too, pal. Same to you.
There you go. Once again, there's Wes Reynolds, at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter, regular contributor to VSiN. Make sure you check him out here throughout the week and this weekend. Coming up on our Thursday edition of Bang the Book Radio, not sure what's going to happen in the first segment, but in our second segment, we'll chat with new Bang the Book writer John Ryan at John Ryan Sports and the number one on Twitter. We'll talk some NBA and some college hoops with him during that segment. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.